I wasn't planning on teaching tonight again, but someone gave me one of these trial memberships to a network of spiritual films, supposedly spiritual films. I won't name it to create a negative advertisement, but I found them all to be too superficial to inflict on you. And embedded in the postmodern ideologies, even regarding spirituality, and most of them remaining within an egocentric frame of reference. And so therefore not of any use or value to the Satyoga transcendental project. So, and then I was in at loose ends because I had no nothing that I felt an urge to teach. And after the last retreat, I no longer make the mistake of trying to have any agency about this, because I know at the last minute the rug will be pulled out from under me. And I'll receive marching orders of a totally different kind than I had prepared for. Which in a way happened again, in the sense that I finally got a message saying, ask Ramana. You know, and so I pulled the book out off the shelf and opened to a page at random and looked at one sentence, and immediately I was stunned perhaps startled also, and this one sentence I immediately perceived contained the entirety of the book that we have just been studying, the Flight of the Garuda. And it was, all of it was enfolded within a few words. So I thought, okay, well, that's a pretty amazing teaching to just to read that, I think, if people will take it in. But it probably will require some digestive enzymes in order to actually make full use of what's contained in it. And I realize we have a new visitor. Yes, Heather, right? Welcome. And so I know that you probably feel somewhat out of the loop, since you're joining a conversation about 13 years after it started, you know. In fact, some would say 20 years, you know, after. So we have accumulated a large vocabulary of terms that mostly refer to non-ordinary states of consciousness that one enters through the practice of meditation, right? And that opens one to not only to the latent potentialities of higher consciousness, but also reveals the subconscious and the sedimentary layers that underlie the ego's current identity, right? Which go back all the way to the prenatal period and infancy and childhood, adolescence, etc., right? And all of those sedimentary layers can obscure and suppress the presence of the lowest sedimentary levels, but they're still there. And they often have the power to erupt and collapse the conscious mind at its current level by triggering a re-traumatization of some forgotten, unbearable memory, right? I'm sure you've probably had that experience, right? So the process of Satyoga is one of purification of those sanskaras, there's one word for you, which are collapsed wave functions, qualium wave functions, which create fixations, predispositions and tendencies, habits of thought, belief systems, and attitudes, orientations, all of that kind of thing that will determine the way that you will look at a phenomenon. And it also includes, let's say, veils of projections into the environment, because you tend to see what you have known in the past and assume that the present is a repetition in some way. This person is like your mother or like your father or what, and that projection then, which may have a grain of some truth, at least at some superficial level of a trait of behavior or looks, etc. But it will then it will warp the relationship and cause a provocation of a repetition of the trauma that was connected to that original other, right? So we're always in one of these kind of psychic whirlpools as long as we're in the ego level. And there isn't the power to escape the pull toward what we call the lower death drive, which are the lower chakras, which are energy forms that have motivated consciousness in its development. But that development often remains stunted because of a repression of unbearable information, that because one doesn't want to see it, one takes defensive measures. And these lead to reactive traits that in yoga they refer to as the gunas. The gunas are often translated as meaning qualities of consciousness. Sometimes you'll see it translated as attributes. Sometimes it will be as habit patterns of predictive programming of how your life is going to unfold, etc. But really, we could say that the gunas refer to bandwidths. If we think of consciousness as on a spectrum of frequencies, and your mind is like a radio with many possible wavelengths, from the very lowest, maybe depressed, suicidal, furious, dreading kind of states, to the most joyous and blissful and ecstatic kinds of states, and everything in between. But this the spectrum of consciousness that at the high end goes all the way to the realization of God and the absolute beyond the event horizon of duality itself, and beyond the illusion of the existence of a cosmos outside of consciousness. All of those fall away at the highest level, but at the lowest level, the consciousness becomes very dense and fixed with a very small, let's call it a mimetic archive, a set of repertoires of imitations of past others who have become a part of the quilt of consciousness with its sub-personalities and its fixed ways of reacting to particular situations. So the ancient yogis have divided the possible sets of qualities or gunas. The word is guna, or you'll hear it sometimes as gun. We can drop the A in Sanskrit in certain grammatical cases. But a guna is, as I say, a bandwidth, and there are three different levels and types of gunas at different vibrational frequencies. The names of these, can you write these on, are sattva, rajas, and tamas. The adjectives being rajasic, tamasic, sattvic. So the tamasic guna, that quality of consciousness, arises and becomes dominant when there is so much past trauma that one has to be engaged in an active defense against collapsing into it. Okay? And that active defense will often require the blacking out of one's consciousness entirely because it's too painful to endure. Just the whatever thoughts and feelings are coming up are too awful. And so this leads to alcoholism and the deadening of one's pain through chemicals, and other drugs are used for the same purpose. And so the tendency to not want to be conscious can lead in the most extreme to a suicidal tendency. But it's always a tendency of fear of one's own consciousness, and therefore a desire not to know what's really going on below the surface. There's a resistance to knowledge, to truth, even though truth sets you free. But before you get free, you've got to feel all of your bondage, and that pain is the residue of the consciousness having been captured under the influence of another that it has never been able to fully escape. So we could say that what the ego is a development of a set of defensive reactions and compensations in order to survive that unbearable pain. One way within the tamasic is the elimination of as much consciousness as possible. Another way of being tamasic is the obscuring or denying of moral consciousness. And then one becomes criminal, psychopathic, completely uncaring about the other, willing to harm the other. You know, people who are, if you can imagine someone taking up a career as an armed robber, you know, they would have to be in a pretty psychopathic state. And of course, there would be a sedimentary history of how that evolved. But nonetheless, the tamasic can be that kind of a demonic choice, or that choice simply to minimize one's capacity to know. And that can lead to habits of attention deficit and just general spacing out and being in daydreams rather than being present, or being in constant states of nostalgia or of rehearsal of unhappy moments and of experiences of feeling lack and inadequacy, and I should have said this and I should have done that and I missed my chance to do this, and all of those kinds of regretful, remorseful, and basically self-sabotaging tendencies. But also it can enact as an aggressivity and a sabotage of the other. So all of this is within the tamasic, right? Enough said, I won't belabor that. The second bandwidth, the rajasic, is more the workaholic. Or there's really two levels of rajasic, right? The second assemblage point and the third are both generally rajasic. But the second is more obsessive and motivated by aggressivity and paranoia. That has to fixate on particular things and perhaps become obsessive compulsive and that kind of thing. And then at the third assemblage point, it's more of a productivity workaholism that is a running away from oneself, but into producing something that has a value that compensates for one's internal feeling of a lack of value as a being worthy of love. And one will try to work one's way out of the hole through good works and acts of kindness and generosity, etc. And when the sublimation channels open up, then the consciousness is motivated by the sattvic vibrational frequency, which is much more governed by ideals. Ideals of goodness, of purity, of generosity, of becoming a bodhisattva, ideals of communion and sharing and giving and including and of in general creating a kind of one for all for one sort of attitude that is necessary if any kind of a sustainable community is to be brought into manifestation. So the sattvic is, you could say, the highest vibrational frequency reachable by the ego consciousness. And the ego consciousness is, you could say, coextensive with who you believe you are as a psychological entity. Okay? A being who is basically constantly thinking and constantly identified with the bodily vehicle and concerned with the well-being of that vehicle, and which has has various psychological motivations, complexes, tendencies, etc. But there is an intention to overcome the internal conflicts that are always there below the surface, because that tamasic level of the subconscious is there, and the ego is always governed by an agency of what is equivalent to the deep state in political terms, or a central intelligence agency, a sensor that will prevent your conscious mind from even being curious about certain things, or remembering certain things, or retaining certain information that could trigger an eruption of a past trauma, etc. So there is a governing agency that is not within the threshold of awareness or control by the conscious mind. And so this always leads to a sense of helplessness and hopelessness in trying to transform the ego's structure and its dynamic way of enacting its pre-installed algorithms. Okay? That's the psychological entity. There's one more assemblage point that's still within the ego, but that I would say refers to the paranormal capacities of consciousness. And very often, people will develop those paranormal powers as a result of childhood trauma, in which they had to become very vigilant and able to read the vibrations of a situation, and to be able to feel, well, how is Dad going to treat me when he comes in the room? Is he angry? Is he going to be abusive? Is he going to want something that's inappropriate? Is he going to make me do something I don't want to do? And so there will have to become a very keen psychic attunement, and this will lead to the ability to have certain kinds of psychic powers. And so let's call this not the psychological, but the psychic level of consciousness. It's still within the ego, but it's a superior level of paranormal perception, which can include the ability to be out of body or have remote viewing or clairvoyance or other kinds of ways of feeling into and matching the vibrational frequencies of others, And one in those states becomes also influenced. The boundaries dissolve, and there is a kind of intermixing of vibrational frequencies, so that the consciousness in the psychic level becomes very often chameleon-like, and is wanting so much to match and to resonate with what's happening and not be captured by it, that it actually loses its own center in the thought constructs that it creates internally to be able to capture those vibrational frequencies and interpret them, right? And these can develop into professional capacities, like body workers who can psychically attune to what's going on and know exactly where to press and how much pressure and all of that to be able to, let's say, release a cut meridian or something like that. Or one can relate to and vibrate at the frequency of other species. There are people who are excellent at working with horses. Some specialize in connecting with dogs. There's a famous woman who can tame wild lions and tigers, and they hire her when a tiger gets too aggressive in a zoo or something. She comes in and she can calm it down and bring it back to being at peace with some trainer who is abusive or something like that. The animals are quite intelligent, but very few humans treat them with the proper reverence and respect. And so those who develop those powers often end up in a comfort zone in which there is an ability to function in the world at a relatively higher state than most egos, but the very powers become a trap, a prison, because they lock the consciousness into the thought constructs that sustain that vibrational frequency. And the psychic is only a very relatively low level on the spectrum of consciousness. It's within, let's say, the shamanic territory of consciousness, but it can never reach the supreme level of total, absolute consciousness because it's still tied to its egoic intentions and drives and internal conflicts that are still projected and that create karmic blowback. And so the psychic becomes a dead end of spiritual growth, which is why the sages of yoga, back even long before Patanjali, said, don't get those siddhis, those supernatural powers, until you get liberation. Mukti first, siddhis afterward, if it is even relevant. But if there's any ego, the real problem with the ego is it has what I refer to as an appropriation reflex. It will try to appropriate everything for its own aggrandizement and use of its will to power. It is not open to surrender. So the process of Sat Yoga is to go beyond the gunas, beyond the psychological and the psychic. So that's the sentence that I basically have pre-digested for you, and now I'll read it to you. He who has renounced the fraudulent mind has renounced the three gunas. He has emerged after completely ripping up the cataract of delusion. Okay? This is from Padamala, in case anybody wants to know, one of the more important of the sayings of Sri Ramana. So, let's just go through this. He who has renounced the fraudulent mind, okay? Why is the ego mind, the ordinary mind of a psychological entity, a sentient being, a normal human, why is it fraudulent? Because it's lying to you. It's deceiving you. It's projecting a world that is based on its past projections as if they're present now. And so it veils what is really here and now. And instead, because of its constant inner narrative, its soundtrack to the movie of its life, it's constantly labeling and judging and predetermining outcomes. It's constantly provoking. It's constantly trying to capture a certain ones, trying to flee from others, and in general, living within an umwelt, an environment in which one's own rejected aspects of the subconscious are projected out into the world in order to feel free of that internal suffering. And then, of course, karma is created in the form of the return of the repressed as the external world and the other. So, the mind and all of the thoughts that you have at the ego level are false. They're delusional. They're based on identifications, on fantasies that your parents had, and forcible ways that you were made to adapt to the family system and then the social order, etc. The hypocrisy of the other that still rankles and creates rebellious and mutinous tendencies, and all of those attitudes that are subliminal but become fully manifest as the enactments of the latent powers that, or let's call them emotional charges that consciousness has and get released as kind of small or large time bombs and that create disruptions and instability and hysterical events and emotional breakdowns, etc. So he who has renounced this, it requires an act of renunciation. This is the only renunciation required, but this is the one that's most difficult, to renounce your own mind. Okay, the one who has renounced the fraudulent mind has renounced the three gunas. Okay, now, it would be easy to renounce the tamasic guna, one would think. I'm glad to get rid of that negredo, right? That black tar that was sticking to my consciousness. And I'm glad to stop running away from myself in the rajasic mode. But get rid of the sattvic tendencies? Mm-hmm. To get rid of that which is virtuous, that which is good, that which has made you a success even, and someone who can be proud of themselves and can feel like you're contributing to the world and you're giving everything and you have this ideal of purity and of bringing goodness and light and love back into the world. That you have to renounce? Yes. Okay, so this is a very basic and a very advanced teaching simultaneously. The gunas are very basic concepts. And so here's the result of one who has renounced it is the second sentence. He has emerged after completely ripping up the cataract of delusion. All right? Now, what is a cataract? It's something that causes blindness, right? So you're ripping away a veil that your own consciousness has put on, like blinders that you put on a horse so it doesn't deviate from the path you want it to take. And veils that have ripped away your power to see through the third eye, which is like X-ray vision that not only can see into the depths of the other, but perceives everything in the depths of one's own subconscious that is projected as the other. And one can no longer blame the other or get away with a blind projection in which one is ignorant of one's own complicity or a causation of a particular event that brings about some kind of an emotional storm, let's say. So the emergence from the blindness is the removal of every veil of consciousness. Every veil, because all of the gunas, right? In other words, any quality or attribute. Now, the subset of every guna is a set of sanskaras, which are particular tendencies that occur within those bandwidths. So when the gunas have been renounced, the sanskaras disappear immediately without having to work through each one, like picking through your garbage or a barber trying to pick up one hair at a time from the floor after a day of cutting hair, you know. No, you sweep it all out at once, right? So if you renounce the gunas, you have basically again become a blank slate. It's like giving yourself total amnesia, or omnesia, we'd say in this case, but complete freedom from the past and from any limited identity that came as a result of that, because consciousness is always inherently free, okay? But one has to choose freedom, and that freedom lies at a frequency beyond the level of any identification, without ego, without the paranormal levels of ego, and without even the limited power of love and of wisdom that comes at the soul level. But the entire renunciation of any quality, even the best of an individual, then removes any possibility, once there's total emptiness, of anything but what remains when these three gunas are gone. Okay? Now, what is that? Well, when the sattvic guna is gone, what remains is sat. That's the source. Now, what is sat? It means the real, that which is eternal, that which is never born, never dies, and never falls into ignorance of its true nature. And it will be perceived as light, love, joy, wisdom, power, and intelligence in general, that can be deployed in an infinite number of creative ways. But the predominant feeling tone is ecstasy, it's bliss, it's joy that cannot, once that renunciation is made, cannot be disturbed by any events in the phenomenal plane, because all of those occurrences are the karmic consequence of those gunas. So this is the secret of transcendence and God realization. And it just requires that one attainment. And then Ramana elaborates this in the next couple of sentences. He who has not seen and embraced the infinite expanse of Mona will be snared by the threefold gunas and suffer in the degraded world. Okay? Expanse of Mona. Mona means silence. So when your mind is completely free of all thought constructs and there is total silence, that brings you to the infinite. And then that infinite presence that is timeless and completely free of any limitation on that which arises within its event horizon, which is, you know, infinite in itself. In a way, we could say there are no horizons, there are no limitations, and that state of divine fulfillment of being becomes embodied. This is the goal of every religion. In Christianity, this is called theosis, or divinization, or sometimes deification, but this is what every Christian should be striving for. This is the commandment. And in the East, more often words like enlightenment or liberation or attainment of the Buddha nature or some term like that is used, but they're all equivalent. So it is this opening that requires the silencing of all tendencies to produce any construct of thought, any image that helps one to organize one's perception, or any affirmation or mantra or any of those props for the mind. They are no longer necessary or useful. And then he goes on, only he who has destroyed the guna mind that wells up and that thus buries the swarupa, or the real self, is a gunatita, one who has transcended the three gunas. So here's yet another word for jivan mukti, or liberation, to become gunatita. So I'd like us all to do an exercise now and take a minute or two and imagine and give yourself permission to really feel into what it is like when your consciousness is free of the gunas. You only need to have a temporary renunciation. It doesn't have to be final, but let yourself renounce the gunas, meaning all thought constructs, all attitudes, all emotions, all sense of a personal identity, until there is only pure presence. Presence free of an I thought. Presence free of any orientation, any context, any paradigm, any boundaries, any world. Consciousness in itself, in your absolute nature that you had before you were ever born, and that is still there in the background of consciousness. Bring the self into the foreground. In total flatlined stillness of mind. And with all veils and obstacles removed, focus on the presence of the source of the power of consciousness itself. Perceive it as energy. as light, as brightness, clarity, joy, openness, freedom, total fulfillment of being, completion of the journey of life, merging, being absorbed into the infinite self. Without remainder, let yourself lock on to that vibrational frequency in which you feel the truth, the reality, the power of this state of pure presence. A state that cannot be disturbed, cannot be harmed, cannot be taken away. Can never be lost. And feel how your heart is fulfilled and released and free from any suffering, any pain. Any regret, any anger, any fear, any desire, completely free. And in this state of gunatita, purity of presence, realize that you have the power to commit to remaining present at this level. This is the real self. And as you vibrate in that state, all the old patterns and predispositions will disappear. And the potential powers of consciousness will be activated whenever needed to serve the self. To function as an instrument of God. Who is the only agency that governs and directs the flow of one's existence? Om Shanti. And when you open your eyes, you can remain in that state and realize that you can be lucid while awake, as well as while dreaming, as well as while the body's in deep sleep. This state is present in every avastha, in every phase of consciousness. And brings the effect of grace. So then it came to me to, how many felt that, the taste of that grace, by the way? Yeah? Okay. Well then, you can be liberated whenever you choose. There's no obstacle. So I was then given 7 guidelines for growth that would help you. Maybe Swati will write these. They're very simple, basically 2 words each. The first one is no hedging. You know, I was reminded of Zero Hedge, but I think they meant something slightly different. But it really means don't hedge your bets. You give it all to the God Self. Don't leave a residue. Don't keep a back door. Don't give yourself a way out. You know, they say in the history we're taught that Cortez conquered Mexico for Spain because he burned his ships and they couldn't go back. It was do or die. Well, we have to have that same Cortesian attitude if we are going to renounce the gunas and not look back or surreptitiously return to them. So, no hedging. Second, no inflammation. It's very easy to get inflamed, to choose to have an emotional charge about something that happened. You always have a choice. Should I get insulted by what they just said or did or didn't say? Or should I feel, you know, wronged in some way? Should I feel oppressed? Should I feel, you know, like I want to retaliate? Or should I accept in the flow of compassion and generosity and understanding an ability to cooperate and accommodate and to be able to create a resonance and a conversation that enables solutions to whatever conflicts or glitches might have conceivably arisen, and to keep the space in one of equanimity. But if you allow inflammation of any kind of emotion, this will probably also be somatized as a kind of inflammatory reaction, as well as various ways of karmically encountering such inflammations. So I think that's an important one. The third is no cutting. Don't cut your ability to connect the dots, your ability to think clearly. Don't cut the flow of the meridians in the nadis, the pranic nerve system of the body. Don't cut the connection between organs and between the central nervous system and the brain and the gut and all of the various motor and peripheral nerve capacities. Let there be a complete enlivened and vibrant network of nerve rivers. Nadis means rivers. And their tributaries and their capacity to nourish every cell of the body with the flow of bioelectrical energies. And there mustn't be any cut between the mind and the prana, any rejection of the vibrancy and life of the body. But the life drive is what gives birth then to what we call the upper death drive, which is the renunciation of the gunas. So infinite life can replace the finite quality of a living entity into an eternally present consciousness of the Absolute. So, and then the fourth would be no blocking, which is, could also be said, called no veiling. But we tend to block out certain things that we don't want to hear, certain inputs that we don't want to see, or we put on rose-colored glasses so we only perceive certain frequencies out there but not see things as they really are. Or we'll put dark, negative tinged glasses and only see the demonic or the paranoia inducing, etc. So there must be no blockage of whether of a flow of information or energy or truth or of the presence of the entire force field of the morphogenic expanse of subtle space and the virtual realities that are always running through and within what gets actualized. So it's a capacity to be aware at the most subtle levels. Then no diversion. So that's another way of stopping one's growth by becoming fascinated with some intermediary level of consciousness and getting hooked on the enjoyment that it produces, but that then again limits and anchors one in a in the phenomenal plane identity rather than in the unborn eternal absolute. Then the next is no projection, and that is probably pretty obvious, but it's very easy to project without realizing you're doing it, and also to introject, to take in the projections of others and be influenced by them without realizing it, and to confuse that with actual communion or communication, because all it really is a projection of is the collusion of two facades that want to create a collective defense of a particular environment or justification of a life path that may not be optimal. And then finally, no hiding, no avoidance, no running away, and no refusal to fully face the significance of the karma and of the messages that are received from the source of consciousness. No fear of loss that would cause you to hide yourself or your treasures from yourself or from the other, but it's a willingness to shine and emanate your true being into the world without any fear or any showing off or display, but a constant emanation into the field, because the perception is that the field itself is the consciousness of God, and there is a constant surrender. So, are those guidelines helpful to people? Okay. So, I think, what time is it? It's getting late. I've talked enough. If anyone has any questions or comments, the mic is up there, and please feel free and let me know if you find Ramana's teaching valuable to you, if you wish, or any clarity that you want about any of this.
Thank you so much, Janya. This the whole night's been very beautiful. I really appreciated the guided meditation as well. Mm-hmm. I feel like I want to try to put into words the dots that have been connecting, and also just to try to speak it and to put it into words, because. Mm-hmm. What I felt in almost immediately in the guided meditation was this constriction in my throat. Mm. And I feel it often when there's that kind of coming into contact with that invitation to go mm-hmm. beyond the identity of the body mm-hmm. and the person. Mm-hmm. And in the guided meditation, I was able to focus on relaxing, like you were saying, mm-hmm. to feel all the pranic meridians mm-hmm. flowing, and there was a more subtle sense of allowing more relaxation to happen, mm-hmm. and I think it was related to then feeling that constriction that I related a lot of the. Some of these ways of the mind recognizing what the story is that I'm holding on to that was created throughout my upbringing, mm-hmm. and seeing how there's ways that I believe in the limitations that I hold on to, mm-hmm. based both on my parents' projections on me, and oftentimes they're conflicting, and so there's this feeling of being stuck in the middle of like a double bind or mm-hmm. a catch-22, where the most recent one that came really clearly was I overheard someone say something about not feeling like I as a character am like an alpha or like a macho kind of man, right? Mm-hmm. And I reflected on that, and it kind of similar to what you were saying of like, am I going to react to that? Am I going to mm-hmm. Go into a kind of a compensatory reaction from hearing that? Or mm-hmm. Instead, I felt like I was able to kind of trace the reaction that I had internally back to the initial kind of parental commands on me, like from my father, not to be, not to overcome him. Like I couldn't be more of a man than he. I had to stay the boy, and he was the man. And then my mother projecting, like, you're supposed to be the he-man. You're supposed to protect me. You're supposed to save me. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I think both of them gave me the command that I couldn't do that either. It was like this, mm-hmm. you've got to give it all you've got, but also at the same time, but you really can't. And so mm-hmm. anyways, that comment triggered me to like reflect on the kind mm-hmm. of origin of the impossibility of that. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like it related to this constriction around the throat, because it's mm-hmm. like that's like an expression of life. And I feel like even mm-hmm. after so many years of like trying to give it all I've got with singing, mm-hmm. that there's still this like inability to really just let it out, mm-hmm. right? And I feel like even speaking, mm-hmm. there's often this sense of like afterwards, I'm like, oh, you did. You should have said that, or like you were saying at the beginning, mm-hmm. This remorse for like not having been good enough, not having done it right, or and all that is involved in that same double bind. And mm-hmm. So I just felt it really beautiful that I could feel a little bit of space from all that, and then, like, I know that that's what you're encouraging us to feel and to allow. And
indeed.
I felt a lot of gratitude.
Wow, that's wonderful. It's very beautiful, Hanuman. Brings joy to hear you articulate this and have such clarity as to the structure of the ego and its limitations that are inherent to it. And you must now realize it's entirely fictional. It's not true. None of those limitations are real. They are just projections of fantasies of the other who needed to feel superior and in control and to keep you captured and at the will of the family system, etc. But you are free, and you have no obligation to hold on to that. In fact, you have an obligation to be free so that you can then be here in the fullness of grace and actually help those others much more than you can from the ego constriction. So you are liberating yourself, and it's a very beautiful and sacred rite of passage that you are undergoing simply through your internal realization of your power to be free of the past and those bondages that were projected as commands of the system on you that have no legitimacy of authority. And you can break them very easily and renounce it and find who you really are and then let that infinite joyous self sing out without any limitations, and it will happen spontaneously. So, very beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Prush.
Question from Solve. There's a tribe in Colombia named Kogi that choose some individuals to become a spiritual leader, and they are kept in a cave for 7 years directly after birth. Would that be the only way to not have the gunas at all, as they will not develop?
I wouldn't recommend that way, actually. No. But it is important to be as if you are a newborn infant in every moment and just feel the wonderment of being in that state in which there are no words, there's no speech yet, there's nothing except presence without a history and with total openness and amazement that is constant and that is completely able to take in the subtlest and most beautiful vibrations of the real without any of those limitations created by the conditioning of the ego, and stay in that state. So the only cave to go into is the cave of the heart, and do it at any age, and it doesn't matter. And often you will actually have more wisdom after a life of being in the cave of ignorance by turning all of that experience into wisdom than would a newborn who was never able to develop the capacity to reason and mimetically be able to emulate the shamans and the sages and the wise beings who could transmit not just sattvic qualities but sat itself and open up one's sat mind to that perfection of presence. But it doesn't require all of those ordeals that are part of the traditional rites of passage. It's really a matter of thinking clearly to the end of the possibility of thought itself to capture reality. And then at that ultimate moment, when you've gone as far as the intellect can take you, of opening, releasing it, letting it go into the infinite consciousness that can never be captured in thought, the inconceivable absolute self. And then that brings you to that state of silence and emptying out of the ego mind, the guna mind, and the fullness of the brilliance of the light of God. That's the way out. So don't go into any external caves, but go into the very center of your being. Is there anyone else? Okay.
Question from Carl. When I had my light experience, I didn't really know what an ego was. And in hearing about the appropriation reflex, I have no doubt that's what followed. Can this be spoken to?
Well, I'm sure that's correct. And that really is what happens with most of those extraordinary moments that people have, sometimes while they're, you know, climbing the north face of some mountain, or maybe they're hang gliding or jumping out of an airplane without a parachute, or, you know, doing very, dangerous things that, because they're life-threatening, they suddenly make you feel totally alive and present, you know. So, you know, runner's high on steroids, these kinds of moments, they can be produced by ayahuasca and other drugs that will bring one into a very temporary state of hallucinatory and somewhat illusory ego death. But there will be a moment in which the ordinary guna mind will evaporate, but it won't last. And the contraction, because of that will to appropriate, will again turn it into an ego maneuver of superiority or of being in the inner circle of whatever. But that ultimate tendency of appropriating, I think, is probably the deepest level of the ego itself. Why? Because the helpless baby needs to appropriate the breast of the mother and get that milk, you know? And so that appropriation reflex becomes mentalized and becomes a need to control and to be able to master. And so because real mastery is very difficult, people settle for fake forms of master's discourse in which they become know-it-alls and little professors or big professors. But there is always an egocentric motivation that dominates, destroys the very freedom that the moment indicates is possible. And leaves it as an article of conversation rather than of realization. So, is everyone free? Why choose anything but freedom? When that is our true nature, and that is being true to oneself, and able to say no to another, and thus also able to say yes. And it is this capacity to spontaneously act from wisdom with an understanding of the holocentric nature of reality, the unity of the many as the one, and always serving the one in the many, but never running away from the many in order to find the one in some cave or solitude or separation, but entering into the many, seeing only the one and serving the one with love and with total generosity of spirit. That's the graduation and the valedictory speech of the silence of the self that has become complete. And so may we all graduate at the top of the class and reach that level of postgraduate liberated sagehood that enables us to bring the Buddha nature the Christ consciousness, the absolute sun of infinite and eternal beauty into the world, shining through your own presence. Namaste.
Namaste.